Talk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Okay, let's say good afternoon and welcome to, as I push the button, Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Ross.
Oh, good day, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Likewise, mate. And you're off for a couple of weeks. You're going OS.
I am going OS. I'll be back on the 24th of September.
Okay. All right, mate. Well, you're going to have a nice holiday. Let's get stuck into it. A couple of questions from listeners. I suppose we're talking vitamin D today, so this is a good question. Elizabeth here says she's taking, is it Atorva?
It's Atorvastatin, which is otherwise known as Lipitor, yeah.
Lipitor, does it block vitamin D from working?
Look, it does have an effect on vitamin D metabolism. So all of these statin drugs, no matter which one you're talking about, has an effect to lower cholesterol. But there is some collateral issues as well. An effect on vitamin D, effect on ubiquinol, which is coenzyme Q10, an effect on vitamin K2, effect on selenium. So there is some issues with taking these drugs. But I say it's very simple to overcome this, especially with vitamin D. Take a couple of thousand units of vitamin D a day, get your vitamin D measured. What we should be aiming for with vitamin D is a level of around 100, so 100 nanomoles per litre. A third of the population, Brent, tragically have a level below 50. And those people, there is a strong link with osteoporosis, heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, depression and asthma. So it is good to keep your vitamin D levels up. But also, if you need to be on a statin because you've had a heart attack, a stent or a bypass, or you've got a high coronary calcium score, it is important that the statins are part of your regimen.
Well, let's talk about, whilst we're talking about vitamin D, let's talk about vitamin D. You wrote a paper to D or not to D is the question.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I thought I'd throw a bit of Shakespeare in there, being the Shakespearean freak that I am. So a few weeks ago, the New England Journal of Medicine released a study where they looked at 25,000 people over 5 years and found that vitamin D in a dose of 2,000 units a day had absolutely no benefit in reducing risk for osteoporosis. So all the conservatives came out and said, see, this stuff's useless, we shouldn't be supplementing, another reason why people are just getting expensive urine. But I also believe you get expensive blood, and I think it was a flawed study. And the reason I think it was a flawed study is it was studying people, men over the age of 50, women over the age of 55. It didn't measure vitamin D levels at the start of the study, and it didn't measure risk for osteoporosis. So people can go off and have their DEXA scans, measure their bone mass on the DEXA scans and see whether they're osteoporotic, osteopenic, or normal. And in terms of preventing osteoporosis, if you have normal bone mass, normal vitamin D levels, taking a bit of extra vitamin D probably won't stop you from having bone fractures. And that's basically all the study did. Didn't look at the much higher risk over 65 population of women and men. 25% of women over the age of 65 get osteoporosis. 5% of men over the age of 65 get osteoporosis. So didn't look at that population at all. Didn't follow them for long enough, because 5 years really isn't long enough to see a major benefit. So I think it was a rubbish study. So I think we can ignore that. But then you've got to look at some other studies that have been done of vitamin E. And there was even from the same trial, Brent. So they're talking about being useless for osteoporosis in that wrong population. But in the same trial showed that if you took 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, you reduce your risk for autoimmune disease, the common things like rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, by about 20%. So, I mean, what's the problem with doing that? So taking two vitamin D a day. Another study that was from what's called the UK Biobank, which has been a big study of about 500,000 people, where they looked at all of their health parameters and some genetic markers as well, showed that people who had the lowest vitamin D levels had the highest rate of inflammation. So a couple of these small vitamin D capsules a day, 1,000 units, two of those a day, can markedly improve your inflammatory markers. Another study looking at this was 53,000 people, 41 randomized controlled trials put together, somewhere between 2 to 4,000 international units a day of vitamin D may help depressive symptoms. Now, I'm not saying you're going to be severely depressed and take a couple of vitamin D and the next day you're going to be great. But it's showing that there is a link between low vitamin D and a benefit from taking a small dose of vitamin D. So 2,000 units of vitamin D a day in most people is pretty harmless. There'll be the occasional person who just have inherently high vitamin D levels, which is why we should occasionally get our vitamin Ds checked. But a study came out a few months ago showing that if your vitamin D levels are closer to 100, you have much lower rates of COVID, COVID complications, COVID death. So I think if you want to look at the balance of evidence, taking a couple of thousand units of vitamin D a day is good for you.
When you go into the chemist and you look for vitamin D, what sort of, when you say 2,000 units, what does that equate to in reference to a tablet?
One capsule is typically 1,000. There's, excuse me, I've still got a cough from that damn COVID I had 6 weeks ago. Yeah, I've still got a bit left with an intermittent cough. I lost my voice 2 weeks ago. So, anyhow, I'm getting better. The one capsule is 1,000 units, but they do have a one a week 7,000 unit one you could take as well. So it depends on what people's preferences are.
Can you take too much vitamin D?
Of course you can. And take too much anything. So, and this is the problem. People think more is better, and more is never better. If you have a headache and I give you a couple of paracetamol, I take away your headache. If I give you the whole box, I kill you.
Mm.
It's all to do with dose, my friend.
What about men and women? Should men take it as well as women?
I think they should, because men or women, 2,000 units a day, a 20% reduction in autoimmune disease. Men or women, 2,000 units a day, less depressive symptoms. Now, and also, I think that if you are low in vitamin D, which is one in three of us, there's all of the other conditions that are associated with a low vitamin D level. So I just think it's a good thing to take.
Over the age of?
Oh, over the age of about 50.
Okay. All right. Second question comes from Graham. He says he's got white spots on his fingernails, and he's treated those in the past with 50 milligrams a day of zinc. He says, how long should I continue with this treatment, and should I also include copper supplements?
Yeah, look, I like people to take copper with zinc. The reason being is if you take a lot of zinc, you deplete your copper, and that can weaken your blood vessels. So it's good to get a balance between zinc and copper. So speak to your health food store people and naturopath about what's the best dose of zinc and copper together. In terms of white spots in your fingernails, yes, it might be due to a slight zinc deficiency, but it could be a whole lot of other things. It could be a fungal infection. Maybe it's psoriasis. So I think it's always important in these situations to get a diagnosis before you actually just go off and get a tonic from a health food store.
Let's talk about salt. We've talked a little bit about salt before, but dietary salt substitutes, that is a substitute, may lower the risk of heart disease and stroke. I suppose you just shouldn't overload on the salt, should you?
No. Look, it's been shown for a long time for the vast majority of the population, not for everybody, but for probably about 90% of people, excessive salt is bad for you. So this big study, which was pioneered by the George Institute in Sydney, Professor Bruce Neal, published in the journal Heart, looked at replacing sodium chloride, which is salt, with potassium chloride. So that's the salt substitute. And they found just by doing that, so I don't think anyone should be adding salt at the table, but if you must do it, use a salt substitute. But by doing that, you reduce the risk for stroke, cardiac events, and just general death in the 12 to 14% range. That was the first study, but then they also did another study which was published in the British Medical Journal Nutrition Prevention and Health, and this is out of London, not out of Sydney, where they got people to reduce their salt intake by about a gram a day. So when you think about that, 5 grams of salt is a tablespoon. So a tablespoon of salt's about 5 grams. So just by reducing your salt back by a gram a day, there was a significant reduction in all sorts of cardiac events, about a 4% reduction in heart disease, 6% reduction in stroke, just by a slight reduction in your salt intake a day. So the message here is don't use so much salt.
Are all salts, e.g. rock salt, sea salt, are all salts?
Of course.
They are.
This crap about, I have Himalayan salt or Celtic sea salt. It's all sodium chloride, for goodness sake. It's no better than the other one.
You mean the pink Murray River sea salt flakes that I've been buying at an exorbitant price and no good?
Yeah. Well, it's still sodium chloride.
It's still sodium chloride, yeah. Okay. So cut back on your salt intake.
Absolutely.
Salt is good for you, though, and you need salt, don't you? You need to replace salt. If you're out in the hot weather and you're doing some hard work and you're perspiring a lot, you need to replace that salt, don't you?
Oh, sure, but you get 80% of the salt that you need from normal food.
Right.
You don't need to add it to the table. The only people who should be adding salt are people who have a specific condition called POTS. Now, tomorrow evening, I'm on a roundtable conference talking about long COVID. And a certain proportion of people who get long COVID are getting this POTS syndrome. So remember, I think he was the yellow wiggle, Greg, the fellow who had the heart attack and,
yes,
and had the stent put in his arteries a couple of years ago. He also had this POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. So it means if you stand too long, you start to get dizzy and your pulse rate goes through the roof and you can collapse. And many people who are getting long COVID are getting this POTS syndrome. And part of POTS syndrome is giving people liberal salt and water because they get a depletion in their intravascular volume and typically their blood pressure is sitting at 100 anyhow.
Asthma affects people of all ages. It often starts in childhood, but asthma can develop at any age. There's currently no cure for asthma. However, current treatments help to keep symptoms under control for most people. New research may have found a way to treat asthma in the long term and return airways to a near healthy state, Ross.
Absolutely. This is interesting stuff because up to now we've used bronchodilators, things like Ventolin, and inhaled steroids as the mainstay of treatment for asthma. And if you're really, really critically ill, possibly the oral steroids as well. Now, this study looked at things called pericytes, which are the stem cells found in the lining of blood vessels, and found that when they exposed mice to dust mites, they induced this allergic asthma. And these pericytes went from the blood vessels into the bronchial cells and caused severe constriction. So they found this inhibitor of a particular protein that did this that made the pericytes move. And when they inhibited this protein, within 2 weeks, the mice were back to normal with no evidence of asthma. So and this was inhaled stuff as well. So we're talking about the potential now to develop this single chemical that can inhibit a protein that can stop the progression of these stem cells inducing asthma in mice. Now, if that works for humans, we've got a whole new avenue of treatment. So it's pretty exciting stuff.
A new study has found that concentrations of toxic chemicals lingering in indoor environments where cigarettes have been smoked can exceed risk guidelines, meaning that non-smokers can be exposed to health risks by living in contaminated spaces.
Mm. Well, you see, people talk about passive smoking, mate, and come the revolution, I'm running the show, cigarettes will be banned. Not banned in public places, I'm just saying banned completely, but it'll never happen, of course. But if you walk into a place where someone has been smoking, and they've now gone, so that's not passive smoking, that's tertiary smoking. All the crap in cigarettes has landed on the furniture, maybe on the person's clothes if you're standing in front of them, they've just had a smoke, and it induces more toxic chemicals than if you're actually breathing in their smoke. So tertiary smoking is probably even worse for you than is passive smoking because of these really dangerous chemicals. So I think smoking in front of another human being is physical abuse. Smoking in front of a child is child abuse. But smoking at all and letting it go onto furniture and clothes and everything else is another form of abuse. And I think it's something we really have to take a hard look at. Because what's going to happen is if people are working in an environment where they're exposed to other people's smoke from that fashion, tertiary smoke, they're going to start to sue their employers for them being exposed to this stuff because it's shown that there are dreadful carcinogens in those sort of products.
What about, people living in apartments and, the person downstairs is smoking on the balcony out the front and the smoke is rising and going into the unit. That's an annoyance, isn't it?
It's not just an annoyance. It does the same thing.
It does the same thing.
If it's landing on your furniture or on your clothes,
it's doing exactly
and you're breathing
the same
it
thing.
In, it's doing the same thing, mate.
Mate, just before I let you go, there's a story today that says scientists are developing technology that seeks out and destroys the deadly blockages that cause thousands of heart attacks every year. The treatment which scientists at the Imperial College in London believe could be given to patients in as little as 3 years. It uses a nanoparticle that identifies and latches on to most dangerous plaques in blood vessels near the heart. A tiny capsule, just a 5,000th of a millimetre in size, releases an anti-inflammatory medicine, breaking down plaque and slashing the risk of a heart attack. This is amazing news.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I was on the Channel 7 News talking about this last night. And so basically what they've done is developed an antibody that targets oxidized LDL. So when you say to anybody, what's the bad cholesterol? Say, LDL, good cholesterol, HDL. That's simplistic nonsense. The bad cholesterol is small oxidized LDL. So this particular antibody targets that, but it's hard to get the antibody into the plaque. So they've now developed this nanotechnology that binds this antibody protein and is targeted to only hit where the oxidized LDL is and leaves the rest of the normal cells alone. So this can then pulverize these oxidized plaques and markedly reduce the fat in the wall and therefore reduce the risk for heart disease. So this is not too far away. Exciting stuff.
It is very exciting stuff. We have to love you and leave you. We always love you. We don't like leaving you, but you're leaving us. So have a great holiday.
And I'll see you in
fantastic
September.
And I'll talk to you in September, towards the end of September.
Good on you, mate.
Thanks, Ross.
Lovely to talk to you.
See you, mate.
Thanks, mate.
Likewise. Bye-bye.